Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World interview recorded on the 22nd of November, 2021. And I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Alexandra Jackson, fund manager of the Rathbone UK Opportunities Fund. Alexandra, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tamsin. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a bit about your background?
Yeah, sure. So I joined Rathbones about 15 years ago, straight from university. I was at Durham. I read economics there, so it was probably a bit of a slippery slope into something to do with finance, but I didn't really know what that should be. And I think sometimes fund management is the kind of shy little sister to maybe investment banking or trading, and potentially not enough people know about it when they leave university. Anyway, I was lucky enough to get the job at Rathbones through a recruitment agent. And so I then spent the first half of my career working with our global team on the Global Opportunities Fund, which is a £4 billion global growth fund now. So with them, I learned how to pick growth stocks, how to run the winners. And then what I really wanted to do is bring that philosophy and a bit of that style back to my home turf, which is the UK, obviously, and kind of focus on UK mid-caps specifically, where I could see this sort of clutch of world-class businesses, but they are a little bit underappreciated, a little bit undervalued, I think. We're not always the best in the UK at valuing growth, I think. So I wanted to bring that style back to the UK and see if we could replicate some of that success here.
Tremendous. So what has the performance of the fund been like year to date against the FTSE All Share and against your peers?
Yeah, so we're up 20% year to date so far. The our benchmark is the FTSE All Share. That's up about 13%. So nice chunk of outperformance there. And then our peers in the IA all company sector is up 16.5%, I think. So again, a bit of outperformance there. I think that's been driven partly by our style. So our style is to buy quality growth companies. And that's been the space that's been in vogue this year so far. But being in mid caps, that, you know, that skew towards mid caps has really helped as well. The mid cap index of FTSE 250 has outperformed the FTSE 100. Small caps have outperformed that again. AIM actually has been the disappointing index this year after an amazing performance last year. So maybe it's just kind of averaging out a little bit. So being in the right area of the market has helped as well. And then some stock picking as well. We've had some, you know, really good successes, particularly with some of our larger holdings. So that's helped a lot. A lot of the tech names actually, or tech enabled businesses have done really, really well this year, really kind of accelerated. We've seen valuations move on, I think partly because of the amount of M&A that we've seen in the UK market this year. And unusually, that's been concentrated in the FTSE 250 or in that kind of mid cap space in general, where for the first time in 20 years, actually, we've seen by value the amount of deals in the FTSE 250 being ahead of the value in the FTSE 100, which is obviously quite difficult just because of the relative sizes of those indices. So that really tells me where, you know, long-term private capital is interested in placing their bets.
And looking back at last year, how did you fare in March 2020? And did you learn anything from that experience?
Learned a lot, definitely. Always learn the most, I think, during crises. So, you know, 2007, 8, 9 was very instructive for me earlier in my career. And then 2020 was another real lesson in, I think, in liquidity and in assessing the solvency of your companies. So mid caps, again, our sweet spot, they bore the brunt really in that very initial sell off, because I think of that liquidity piece, and people feel like mid caps are going to fare worse sometimes in a crisis. But then actually they bounce back hardest, which is really interesting. And I think that's slightly to do with the style and the sector balance in the UK. So the good thing about the fund during the period was that because we didn't have any redemptions, we didn't have to trade at all, really. So we didn't have to you know, we didn't have any cash calls to meet. And the spreads were really wide in the space during March, April. So we just didn't really want to do anything. I think you can do quite a lot of damage to a portfolio if you, you know, if you're forced to trade during those periods of stress. So we didn't do that. We kind of hunkered down a little bit instead. We spent a lot of time assessing the solvency of our companies. So working out, you know, how many months they had until their liquidity ran out. That was really important. Assessing the leverage. As always in crises, you get investors who sell things based on how much leverage they have, and they just sort them in terms of highest to lowest leverage and start selling at the top. So that was really interesting to look at. And we can certainly see that in the performance of some of our stocks. And then the other thing we did was liquidity. So we built a kind of very stressed liquidity scenario in case we did have any redemptions. We were lucky that we didn't in the end. But, you know, that's really, really important. And we also then kind of worked out which companies we thought would come back to shareholders and ask for a little bit more money. And then we could work out which companies we wanted to support either in the fund or potentially with new positions. So we were ready when those equity calls came, and we had some cash for that.
So let's go a little bit into your selection criteria. I think you talk about a scorecard criteria. Could you expand on that and give us some examples of that?
Yes, sure. So as I said, it's a multi-cap fund. We like having that flexibility to go up and down the market cap scale. So we are looking, you know, from small caps all the way up to FTSE 100, into AIM and into IPOs as well. So it's a big universe. So you kind of need a filter, a way to reduce, you know, the number of stocks that you're looking at. So a couple of the things that we like to focus on are, I would summarize as scalability, durability, quality, and governance. And those are some of the factors that I observed when I was working on the global fund. It was those things that really made stocks stand out. So some of the most successful stocks that I've seen in my career share those characteristics. So I want to really double down and focus on those when I'm looking in the UK mid-cap space. So when we talk about scalability, that is around operating leverage. So being able to add more revenues into the business and grow your margin. So companies that can do that really well, one of our top performers in recent years, Future, which I think probably lots of mid-cap fund managers own, which is a really interesting online media business. So if you're looking for maybe a new computer or some new speakers or all sorts of different things, you might Google, you know, which speakers should I buy? And up will come a website. It's probably owned by Future. They will do the reviews, and then there's a little link you can click on to buy the product. That's a really interesting business. They just need to keep putting content in the top of the funnel, and cash and profits seem to come out of the bottom of the funnel. It's a super business. Another one that we really like, much smaller than Future, is called Keystone Law. It's a legal services firm. So they use a decentralized model where their lawyers are self-employed, essentially. They bill their clients for their whatever, you know, conveyancing or family law, or maybe it's commercial disputes. They bill their clients, and the lawyers don't actually get paid until their clients pay them. So it's also got a lovely cash cycle as well in there. The more lawyers you add to that model, the bigger the company gets. Durability, that is around your pricing power, I think, and therefore pricing power is what protects your margins, and that is what helps companies to perform through cycles. So about the durability of the stock and the business that underlies that. One of the companies that we think really exhibits this actually issued numbers this morning called Diploma. They're a specialist distributor of all sorts of little industrial components, which is an area that is, you know, really under fire at the moment in terms of this supply chain issue and the ability of Diploma to pass through those increased prices that they are seeing because of these issues with supply chain is what really protects their margins. And then quality, that's around cash conversion, looking through the report and accounts as well. That's really important in this space, working out where the funnies are, the stuff that management doesn't really want you to see. They definitely don't put it on the front page of the presentation. A company like Halma, which is a FTSE 100 business, but we've owned it for many, many years. They handle their report and accounts perfectly. So everything is expensed. Everything is put through the P&L properly. There are no kind of off balance sheet funnies there either. And then governance, it's very important in this mid-cap space. I think the momentum of ESG and governance particularly is probably how you're going to add your edge here, because not all small, medium-sized companies are able to have a perfect ESG score. They just don't have the time and the resource to achieve that. So sometimes it's the direction of travel, it's the change that you see in that. A company like Greggs, for example, they treat their staff very, very well. They pay bonuses on top of their natural wages. And I think this will really help them in this scenario that we're facing now, where potentially there's quite a bit of wage inflation coming through in the kinds of jobs that Greggs hires for. But because of that loyalty that they've gained by treating their staff well and giving them those £400 bonuses over the years, they should be better insulated from that. So governance is very important from an ESG standpoint, but it's also really important from the business kind of resilience point of view as well.
All of those companies that you mention are high quality companies because of those criteria, but they don't come cheaply. Can you talk a little bit about valuation and maybe companies that haven't quite grown into their valuation?
Yes, there's plenty of those. You know, and to kind of get the comfort of that quality blanket, you know, you do have to pay up sometimes. But that's why we need to focus on that durability bit and the scalability, because if potentially some people would say that, you know, that valuation, that headline valuation isn't very appealing today, we're interested in thinking about how long that growth can last for, and how quickly it can scale up or how much it can scale up. And actually that is what brings your valuation down. So for us, we're looking at more than just what the sell side thinks that these companies are going to be able to do, more than what the analysts put in their numbers. And I think that's what we can bring from, you know, from my experience looking at global stocks. It's sort of about knowing what good looks like and trying to find those companies that can, you know, sit on the world stage alongside other global success stories because of that scalability, that durability and that quality. And yes, you do sometimes have to pay up for that.
So do you have any stocks in the portfolio that have got a PE of less than 25?
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely.
Because all of the ones I've looked at seem to be sort of 30 to 40, so except perhaps Greggs and Future.
Yes, no, there are. There definitely are. I would say some of the industrial names that we own, those trade on a much lower valuation because they can be a bit more cyclical. Some of the house builders, we own a house builder called MJ Gleeson, which is a very small house builder. So instead of building, you know, tens and tens of thousands of houses every year, they build probably 2,000 houses a year. The average selling price is £160,000. So a couple earning the minimum wage could buy one of these Gleeson houses. So it's really playing into that area where there is massive undersupply. And it's kind of, you know, they change lives by doing that. Beazley is another company that probably still needs to, I would say, do a little bit of work on the share price. I think the market has been unsure around its cyber exposure. So Beazley is an insurer, and one of their differentiators, I would say, is that they write insurance for cybersecurity, which not many people do. But the market doesn't really understand it, doesn't really understand how a cyber catastrophe would work. But I think Beazley this quarter have done some really good work in explaining to the market how they would do that. Also talking to the market about climate change, about adding a levy onto most of their policies around climate change because they can't, you know, model it perfectly. So Beazley is, you know, cheap compared to the market. It's cheap compared to its history. It's cheap compared to its peers. And I think probably is worth, you know, worth quite a lot more than it's trading on now.
And if we look at IPOs, there've been a phenomenal number over the last year. Yeah. What are your favourite IPOs that have happened over the last year?
So Oxford Nanopore, which happened recently, is, I mean, just a fantastic company that is really interesting. And we're thrilled to see a company like that listing in the UK. But another one of our kind of favourite IPOs, because it wraps up a part of our investment philosophy a bit better, was Bytes Technology Group. And they IPO'd in the middle of December last year. So a little less than 12 months ago. It's an IT reseller company. So they help small, medium-sized businesses with their IT needs. So not just about issuing, you know, hundreds of laptops to to workers during the pandemic. But this is about software, making sure you've got the right cybersecurity products, the right firewalls, the right remote communications, all of those things that, you know, companies really have to kind of double down on at the moment to ensure that they're future-proof. So a company like Bytes has this huge structural demand behind it. The important thing about IPOing a company like that is that you set the expectations properly. So the worst thing that we see in an IPO, the thing that really turns us off, is when we think that management have just put out these very aggressive assumptions around what they think they can do over the next couple of years, because it's just really, you know, setting yourself up for a fall, and it's very hard to come back from that. But we felt that Bytes left enough on the table. The guidance was quite conservative, and actually they've managed to upgrade their guidance twice since then. And the shares have doubled since floating less than 12 months ago. It was floated by one broker. It was done quite quickly in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I never really expect Bytes to hit the headlines. And that actually, to us, is more, those are more of the building blocks of a great IPO.
And do you think the appetite, the institutional appetite for IPOs, is starting to wane now?
Yes, I think probably it is. Yeah. We've seen a lot of IPOs this year, as you point out. Some of them have been great. You know, Trustpilot, Oxford Nanopore, absolutely fantastic. Bytes, brilliant IPOs. And then there have been some more recently that, you know, the quality, the structural demand, it's just not there. They're a bit too niche, maybe. We're also seeing lots of companies pulling their IPOs. And I'm also seeing more companies doing a dual track process. So they're trying to IPO, but alongside it, they're also trying to sell themselves to probably a private equity house. You know, the sheer quantity of that, I think, probably just gives investors a little bit of fatigue. We're in the middle of one at the moment, actually, which does look quite exciting. So, you know, watch this space on that one. But I think probably that's, you know, that's probably the last one we'll do for the rest of the year. Maybe they'll pick up again in January. But, you know, I can see the pipeline has dried up as well in response to that fatigue that I think you rightly point out. And we're still seeing listed companies, you know, coming to the market, raising cash as well. So, you know, there's only a kind of finite pool of cash that investors have to hand over.
But surely those capital raises as well are reaching a fatigue point with institutions.
Well, I don't know. It depends on the stock, definitely. For something very compelling, you know, a company that's raising money for an acquisition, which is very compelling, accretive, that's been, you know, well flagged, then I don't see a shortage of support for those at all.
And I know you're quite keen on tech. Where do you think the UK does well with tech? And where would you suggest investors get good exposure?
Yeah, it's my biggest overweight, or almost my biggest overweight, I think. So, you know, everyone says there's no tech in the UK, 1.5% of the index, I think, which isn't really, you know, it's not good enough really, is it? But if you can look in the 250 in small cap and in AIM, then there is lots of tech in the UK, but it's different to, you know, global tech. We don't have as many of those sort of household names, you know, the consumer brands, so the Netflix, the Amazons, the Spotify's type things. What we have is the plumbing, you know, the more B2B side, business to business. So it's kind of the back end of the technology. So it's different. That has a different risk profile, different margin profile, different growth. So you have to value it, you know, you have to look again at valuation. But there are some really super tech businesses in the UK. So Kainos is one of our largest holdings, for example. They are writing the code to help the government to digitize at the moment. So if you renew your driving license online or your passport or any of those interminable forms that we used to have to fill in, all the different colored forms, and then take them to the post office and have them checked, you can do all that online now. And whereas it costs the government £20 to process a physical form, it costs them 50p to process one that you do online. So it helps us, but it also helps the government hugely as well. So Kainos are writing the code and implementing that. Not really a household name, I would say, but again, huge structural growth behind it, extremely high margins, very well regarded, well incentivized management team, very inspiring management team. Then there's another company in the UK, which I think is very interesting, called Molten Ventures. It's just changed its name to that. Most people will know it as Draper Esprit, which is a listed venture capital firm. So it's FTSE 250 listed, has a range of stakes in some really interesting technology companies, some really sort of deep tech like Graphcore, which is they make chips for semiconductor chips for use in AI, and then more kind of consumer things like Cazoo, the car retailer, car dealer, secondhand car dealer, Trustpilot. They had TransferWise as well, UiPath, Revolut. So you can get exposure to a whole range of global, very early stage tech companies through a UK listed VC business, which is really interesting.
But it is trading at a premium to its NAV. Is it worth paying that premium?
It is at the moment trading at a premium to NAV. Obviously, you don't want to pay too much of a premium, I would say, to that. But you know, we're looking at that's kind of a backward looking NAV. So I think you want to be looking, you know, 12 months forward to understand how much growth you think the market is pricing in. Some of these companies are growing at, you know, 60, 80, 100% a year. Not all of them, of course. It's, you know, that's the point of a portfolio. So I think there's a lot of growth to come out of these businesses. And that's what we trust the management of Molten to do, is to keep recycling the capital away from, you know, some of those listed companies now, Trustpilot, Cazoo, where perhaps the growth is a little bit lower, and recycle it back into those, you know, mega 100% growth businesses. And that's how you justify the premium to the NAV.
And with Kainos, it's on a PE of 45. Are you comfortable with that? Or do you think that that's getting a bit stretched as well?
Yeah, again, I don't see it on a PE of 45. My numbers look a little bit different a couple of years out. I think again, the market isn't brilliant at pricing in or analysing, forecasting the durability of that growth. So I can see the runway that they have for wins with the government, but also on the kind of corporate side as well. The other part of the business is that they help companies to implement Workday, which is a £60 billion US software company that helps with payroll. Again, no shortage of growth runway for that business, and therefore Kainos can kind of ride on their coattails to a certain extent. And if you look at the valuation of similar businesses in the US, they are, you know, in the very much in the same ballpark. So while it looks expensive for the UK, I don't think you want to be necessarily just comparing it to other UK IT services businesses because of its global reach, global footprint now. I want to be, you know, comparing it to its true global peers.
And are there any companies that you haven't mentioned that you think are going to be the real ones that are going to move the dial next year?
Oh, lots of those. I think Intermediate Capital is going to continue to do brilliantly. That's a FTSE 100 business, but again, not for long. It's just kind of graduated from the 250. That's a third party fund management business, but they work in alternative assets. Incredible growth. I think more and more people are looking to allocate a part of their wealth to alternative assets, not just equities and bonds. And if you're going to do that, you definitely want to do it with someone who has an amazing track record. So Intermediate Capital having great success with raising funds and deploying them into, you know, really interesting parts of the market. CLOs, mezzanine debt, lots of things that I don't really understand. Where, interestingly, the fees are not coming under the same pressure that we find in other parts of the market. So that speaks to the kind of durability and the scale of that business as well. So I think it's, you know, it's just in the kind of foothills of the FTSE 100 now, and I think there's lots more to go for. Its peers, other companies like Partners Group, EQT, trade on a much bigger multiple. They're a lot bigger, that, you know, they're a bit further down the road. So I can see a nice path for Intermediate Capital. Other names, Axis Technologies is a very small company at the moment, 300 million or so, just under 300 million. They take softwood, which is easy to grow, fast to grow, not very resource intensive. They put it through a process, a modification process, which I always say is a bit like what my children do to conkers during conker fighting season. So it's more complicated than vinegar and a low oven, but it essentially produces a similar result, which is to give the wood the quality of hardwood. So it becomes dimensionally stable, i.e. it doesn't swell in the rain. It will last for years and years. It's carbon neutral. That is a really interesting company. They are completely sold out in terms of the wood. They can't add capacity fast enough. I think that's really one to watch.
And any others? One more?
One more. Oh, I think Greggs could do very well this year again. They are extending their opening hours. They're moving into delivery. This is a, you know, British brand that people absolutely love and has, you know, I think changed perceptions in terms of its stock market view very much as well. So I think we'll see great things in terms of profit, but also cash from Greggs this year.
And I always think we learn the most from our mistakes. What do you think's the biggest mistake you've made, maybe on this fund or in your career, and what did you learn from that?
Lots of mistakes. It's always hard to pick one, but one that I've been thinking about more recently again was ASOS. So we bought ASOS in 2017, I guess, because we could see what we thought we could see a runway to enormous sales growth. And where we thought the market was more comfortable with the margin investment that would require, i.e. the margin had to go down a little bit in order to achieve that amazing growth. We were comfortable with that. I think we probably overestimated the extent to which the market was comfortable with that. And so what followed from there was, you know, downgrades to margin. Very painful for a stock that was trading on very punchy multiples because of that long-term growth potential there. So eventually we sold it. Then it went up a lot after that. So one of those very frustrating moments where you buy it, it falls, you sell it, it rises. You feel like you can't get it right at all. At the moment, you know, we've been looking at it again. They're suffering with some warehousing issues, maybe not being able to get their supply chain sorted out in time for Christmas. So we'll have to watch that. And lots of management change as well. But having got it wrong twice already, I'm not super keen to go back into it. But that's sort of why we have this scorecard, because I don't necessarily trust my emotions now to call it correctly. So we use the scorecard to strip out that emotional side and keep it as objective as possible and go through the list of the scorecard and see what it tells us.
And as a female fund manager, which I think is fantastic, do you think the different genders have different strengths and weaknesses in terms of investing and fund management?
I never really like to kind of categorize people in terms of their gender so much. I think everyone has different strengths and weaknesses, you know, whatever the sort of outward category they fall into. Fund management is a great job, full stop, and it's a great job for women as well, because you are largely in control of your own diary, which is great if you have any caring responsibilities. It requires a lot more emotional intelligence than I think most people would realize. You know, you don't have to be some kind of maths genius to be a good fund manager. I think that emotional intelligence, common sense, kind of street smart side is a lot more important, actually. A lot of the best fund managers that I see, they're not the most intelligent people who've ever walked the earth. What they have is that common sense and that ability to see patterns in huge amounts of data. I think women are brilliant at that. So I would say it's more about the individual than the gender, but absolutely no reason why more women shouldn't do this job. It's wonderful for women.
And do you think it's easier for women to get into fund management these days?
I hope so, but I think there's probably a long way to go. We need to, you know, widen that net of people that the pool that we're recruiting from without lowering the bar. That's the key for me. And also getting that message out there that this is a great job for women. Potentially the ESG, the greater focus that we all have now on ESG will help that. To show that there's a genuine social purpose to this industry as well.
Alexandra, thank you so much. Where can people find out more about you and the fund?
So on our corporate website, which is rutm.com, rutm.com, we have a page around the Rathbone UK Opportunities Fund. You could also follow me on LinkedIn, Alexandra Jackson, or have a look at Trustnet, Morningstar, Fund Calibre.
Tremendous. Thank you so much for your time. It's been brilliant.
great to talk, Tamsin. Thank you.
And to our listeners, please comment on the content on the various social media platforms. This helps us get the very best speakers. To subscribe to receive a notification of a new video as it's published with no spam, go to piworld.co.uk. At the top, on the side, subscribe. Many thanks for listening and stay well. PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.